This is Blueprint for Living. I'm Jonathan Green, and this is Lost and Found. This week, Everest.
A New York Times journalist asked the question, why climb Everest? Mallory gave his legendary reply. Because it's there.
James Strohfeldt is a climber, and in this most recent Himalayan climbing season reached the summit of Everest. James, why Everest?
The short answer, the answer most people would give, is that it's the highest. And many think it's the most difficult, but that's not the case. As you say, I'm a climber and I've been steeped in climbing lore and story for 40 years. And that story has had Everest as one of the sort of focal points. And I was there early in my climbing career on the south side. And it has always been a place I've been connected to. It still exists for me what's the word? You know, there's so much gathered around it in the climbing community.
In mystique? Significance?
Yes, mystique, significance. It is the place where so much happened in the history of climbing. You start, you know, with Mallory and Irving in the 1920s and all the way through since then.
And yet, as you say, it's not necessarily the hardest thing you can do in climbing.
No, not at all. Especially these days, where it barely qualifies as climbing. There are harder mountains and you can go as far as you want in terms of difficulty. There are still lots of mountains that haven't been climbed in China and Central Asia, and there's lots of routes that haven't been climbed because they're still too difficult for today's alpinists.
And there it is, though. It is the highest. So there's a sense there of human conquest.
Yes, there is. I think that is always present in all human endeavour. It's part of our nature. It's something perhaps you start off with in climbing, but because of the nature of what climbing is, you move beyond it to some extent. So it's still there, but it's not the be-all and end-all of what you're doing.
The nature of what climbing is. What is that?
Well, it stops being about, all that patriarchal language. If you read climbing books, 99 out of 100, written in heroic mode, they talk about the assault on the mountain and the conquest and all that sort of thing. None of that is true at all. It's just one particular, patriarchal perspective on it. You spend enough time in the mountains and it stops being something like that. It becomes more about a communion with nature, and nature in its rawest, unspoiled form that's beyond the insurance and the safety belts and the controls that we live in most of the time.
You're pitting yourself against the possibility of death in an inhospitable environment.
Yes, it's not just that. As I said, it's the communion with nature, right? And that brings out all sorts of things to you. But the fact that in climbing as opposed to, say, bushwalking, you may die in the next few minutes if you do something wrong. And that has an enormous focusing effect. It tunes you into your circumstances. It results in a complete awareness of your body and the environment and what's going on in your mind, like a meditation.
And I wonder in that communion with nature, whether the mountain, and in this instance, that particular mountain, Everest, has almost a sort of divine presence.
I found it so. And I've been thinking a lot since about why that is. I've been on mountains just about as big and more, of all sorts, all over the Himalayas and other places. And Everest seemed really special. And I am still asking myself why that is. It was definitely magnificent. And most of the big 8,000-metre peaks, there's 14 in all, most of them amount to not that much more than a snow trudge, I suppose. There's not many spots on them where you have to use your hands, where you have to use ice axes facing into the face. There are some, but on the standard routes, that's not common. The south side of Everest is just a walk with a couple of steep bits. The north side is a whole another level. It really is a mountaineer's or a climber's route, and it's steep and it's rocky. Most of it's rock, not snow, and it's technical. So it's not just a sort of white slope that you're going up. It's an absolute sculpture, and it just is magnificent in the way that nature can sometimes be daunting and hostile and awesome.
Everest conquered, the New Zealander Edmund Hillary got his first mail and congratulatory telegrams from George Lowe, a fellow countryman and expedition colleague. Just 35 miles from Kathmandu, capital of Nepal, Hillary and Tenzing were welcomed and congratulated by their fellow members of the expedition.
Tenzing brought the family along to share in the excitement, but for all of them, the ordeal wasn't over. For now came the inevitable questioning about that moment of near disaster when Tenzing's presence of mind saved his friend and colleague from a fatal fall.
Tenzing and I had been climbing together a good deal, and I think we'd become a fairly happy pair. Mm. And this was just one example of how a pair roped together are a unit, and how one is always protecting the other. I was leading down the ice fall, and when I was crossing a crevasse, a large lump of ice gave way on which I was standing, and I set off down down a crevasse. Well, Tenzing, who was following, had the rope tight in a very short time and pulled me up, so I didn't go very far.
And how did Tenzing feel up there on top of the world?
He's very happy.
So the pictures we saw this year of long queues in that slightly sloping walk that you describe is the south side. You were on the north, on the Chinese, the Tibetan side of the mountain.
Yes.
That begins at a base camp?
Yes, and unusual for a big mountain, the base camp is at the end of the road. You can drive there.
So you can get anything into that base camp.
Yes, and they do. I was on a relatively inexpensive trip, but the average cost is very high to climb Everest, and on the north side at least, part of what you're paying for is the facilities at base camp. So the more expensive trips had huge geodesic domes as their mess tents, and if you looked, and the panels of the domes were see-through, so they had panoramic windows, and inside they had sofas and coffee tables and even baristas. There's electricity too at base camp, and there's internet, and so, as I say, it's not like most mountaineering.
The other thing that money can buy you at that altitude is oxygen.
Yes, $500 a bottle. It's the first time I've ever used oxygen. I've been to 8,000 metres before without it. The difference is unbelievable.
Describe that.
Well, it's just not like being at 8,000 metres. It's it effectively, depending on how much you're breathing, it effectively drops you thousands of feet, if not thousands of metres, in the air that you're breathing. So once again, if you can afford it, you can breathe a whole lot of oxygen, because you need Sherpas to carry all the bottles up for you. And you can start breathing it at base camp, and you can sleep on it all night, every night. And with this being possible, there was one woman from San Francisco who climbed Everest on the north side this year in 13 days, home to home, from San Francisco to the top and back again.
I take it that's quick.
because normally you have to acclimatise for weeks, and so that you can get enough changes in your body to tolerate a fair degree of hypoxia. To climb Everest without oxygen is rare, and to do so you would want to acclimatise for at least a couple of months, and who's got the time these days to do that?
This, of course, is where so many people got themselves into trouble with delays, not necessarily approaching the summit but coming down with inadequate oxygen for that lengthened trip.
Yes, because you the normal time to the summit on the south side is about 10 hours from the high camp, and because of the queues, this was stretched out to as much as 16, 18 hours. And, of course, people not anticipating that, they didn't have sufficient oxygen. When I was coming down, I was breathing about 2 litres a minute, bit less sometimes, bit more sometimes, on that summit day. And when I was coming down, somehow my hose disconnected from the regulator. I thought I'd had a pulmonary embolus, and I couldn't catch my breath, and I almost had to, had to sit down. And I do very well at altitude. I was fairly well acclimatized, and yet that's how it was. And I probably could have got down, but it would have been touch and go. I'm experienced, as I say, and for someone who's far less experienced and doesn't know how to manage themselves, it would be a very serious situation.
Lost and Found here on Blueprint for Living, this week on Everest with climber James Strohfeldt.
More people have died climbing Everest this week than in the whole of last year. Record numbers have been making the ascent, trying to take advantage of the weather conditions. The crowds have been blamed for a surge in cases of exhaustion and dehydration. It's led to calls for the number of permits to be limited.
Yeah, Poppy, and this is why it's so deadly, because that area where all those people are backlogged, that's known as the death zone.
And there's we read and saw so much of the crowds in this season, but you had an extraordinary opportunity to be on the side of that mountain alone.
It was extraordinary. And you asked earlier about why Everest and why it was special for me. And I was thinking how there's a number of things and how fated or lucky it was that the things had happened to me. One of the things was on the eve of the summit, the day before, and we were going to head for the summit at 10 o'clock that night from the high camp. So we were moving up that day from Camp 2 to Camp 3, Camp 3, the high camp. And because of various factors, almost everyone was planning to go to the summit on roughly the same day, which was not a good thing because it would result in crowds. So we were heading up from Camp 2 in the early afternoon, and there were probably 150 people, maybe more, on the fixed ropes. And so they were going past, and I joined this train, and I took a few steps. I'd gone 30 metres maybe up this 40, 45 degree slope. I was on snow, and suddenly I slipped, and I looked down, my crampon had come off. And the people going past looked at me and just thought, "You're fucked." And I thought so too. Without a crampon, you can't really function. The crampons are the spikes that clamp onto the base of your boots. And if you haven't got a sole on your shoe, then you can't use them. Not only would I not go up, my expedition was over, but I would struggle to get down. Amazingly, I had a half tube of glue. I don't know why one would not normally carry that and pack it every time as you moved up the mountain, but I had it. And after a little time, I remembered the fact, and I went back to the tent and I repaired my boot. It took 2 or 3 hours to set, and in minus 10 degrees, I didn't know if even it would, but it did a remarkable job. And so at 4:30, I headed out towards Camp 3. Everyone else had gone because they'd all started at more like 12:30. And so I went from Camp 2 at 7,700 metres to Camp 3, 8,250 metres. 8,000 is the cutoff, you're 26,000 feet. That's where you move into what's called the death zone. And so I went through that area entirely on my own, couldn't see another person. And it was in the evening, and the sun was low in the west, and it was, what's the word, numinous experience. It was just amazing. And despite the hundreds of people on the mountain, I had an entire section like that to myself. It was just me and Everest. And we bonded, I suppose. Well, at least I did.
What was in your head and heart in that time?
I think I felt joy. I felt lucky that this boot thing had happened, A, that it had happened, and B, that I had a solution to it. Everest always, I was aware of the bodies. One of the corpses on Everest was a dear friend of mine, and he died there in 94. And I know roughly where he was. And as I climbed up towards his highest camp, I was looking across the North Face. I could see where he still rests. And there are a lot of bodies on Everest, and not that many that you see, but there's scores that are there. And each one of them has a story attached to it. And if you're a climber, you know a lot of these stories. So there's a sense of moving through that reality and that history.
No worst, there is none. Jared Manley Hopkins. Oh, the mind. Mind has mountains. Cliffs of fall, frightful sheer, no man fathomed. Hold them cheap, may who ne'er hung there. Nor does long our small durance deal with that steep or deep. Here, creep, wretch, under a comfort serves in a whirlwind. All life, death does end, and each day dies with sleep.
To the summit next. You do that from the very early part of the day, or from the evening?
From the evening, yes. So why do you climb at the night? Because you don't want to end up coming down from the summit in the dark. That's a bad thing to do. And so you need to get up there sufficiently earlier so that you can get back down before it gets dark. The reason it's much harder, well, it's harder going down in the dark than going up, but also you're tired, you're dehydrated, you're exhausted, I suppose. You've run out of oxygen, possibly, if you've run into trouble, so that's not a good time to be negotiating these things. And it used to be that you'd start sort of 1 or 2 in the morning, or then 12. Now it's more like 10. This is partly because of the crowds. So we were planning to start at 11 in the end. So I got to camp 3 at about 7:30 in the evening, sat in the tent for a few hours trying to hydrate and eat something. It's very difficult to eat at that altitude. And at 11 o'clock, we headed out into the dark and kitted up and headed out into the dark and the cold.
This is an extraordinary thing about that number of people in such an extreme environment, that there's no sort of reassurance from that human presence that it's dwarfed.
No, I think the experience would be different if you're on your own. I mean, it is. It was surprising how much I felt on my own despite the people ahead of me and behind me. And there is very much that sense of one's own private journey. One of the factors is that everyone is in huge down suits with hoods and oxygen masks and glacier glasses or goggles.
So it's dehumanized.
Very much so. You can't recognize anyone unless have spent a lot of time with them and their particular color of down suit. So no, you don't really know anyone. The wind is blowing. You're in a bit of a dream state. You're somewhat hypoxic. Because of the wind and the oxygen mask, you can't really talk to anyone else. Your pool of awareness is pretty restricted to the little circle of light cast by your headlight, which you have on low beam because you want to preserve the batteries. So your world narrows right down into your own personal space and your own journey through this particular terrain.
Take us to your last few steps to the top.
Just before the last few steps to the top, you do a traverse across the top of the North Face, and it's very balancey, and you're in the top few metres of an 8,000-foot face. It's very exposed. It's awkward. Not scary. I don't know. I think you're sort of past being scared by that stage, but it's exciting. And then you do a turn, you go up a bit more, and then you come onto the summit ridge, and it undulates like a beautiful sinusoidal wave. Once again, it's like a sculpture. It makes you think of a deity. And so this wave of snow on the left, it drops down on the Kanchung face, and just it's corniced on that side, and it goes for maybe 150, 200 metres to the summit, which is just the highest wave of snow. And on that, it looks like there's a cocktail party of people, which once again didn't matter. I didn't mind. But the other thing was, the sun was, it was 8 in the morning, the sun is coming up to the left in the east, and the wind is blowing from the west, and it's blowing all the snow off this summit ridge, and the snow crystals are filling the air, that plume you sometimes see coming off the top of mountains, and you always think, gee, I'm glad I'm not up there because it's windy. But it was like that, and so the crystals in the air were doing things to the sun, and you know, the rays, it was like a laser show at a rock concert. It was just amazing. And as I said, you're in a dream state, and you're closing in on this sort of, well, for me, it's something that's been in my mind for 40 years. I was just ecstatic, I think. You know, I was sort of having to hold back the sobs.
Did part of you want to stay there?
No. Despite all of that, I think that all that I've just said, that summit is not the reason I go to mountains, it's the journey. And it was like...
And that's only half done.
Yeah, well, there's that, yeah. But it's also like doing a pilgrimage, you know, and you don't want to stay at the place of the pilgrimage. The pilgrimage is in the greater context of your life, and its meaning is only really bedded down when you move back into your life, having gone through the journey. And I think it was like that.
Everest, an Elegy by Jennifer de Guzman. They are 200 or so, lying where the veil of cold softened the senses, shrouded each finger, each toe, each limb, each breath, clouded the eyes with the shadow of the peak that would be their eternity. They must have dreamed the summit like a needle in their mind's eye. For the sake of one fractured moment with their feet above all else, they have become what they are. They have found each other, laying down in the shelter of stone. The boots, the only green for miles.
So let's go back to that post-Everest life. What do you attempt to hold on to from that experience?
Yeah, I think it's the connection to self and to nature. And you can get that in all sorts of ways. You know, you can do meditation retreats and you come away with that, and gradually the noise builds back up in your head and that sense of connectedness gets drowned out again. And that's the feeling. That's what happens with climbing. It's a beautiful way to access that awareness and connection, not just to oneself, but to nature, and I suppose to humankind as well. So that's why you keep going back. That's why you keep climbing.
Because everything that you return to works to overwhelm that, works to undermine that sense that you've just discovered, I imagine.
Yes, to a degree. I think the way you experience the world at home depends on your perspective, and that's the task when you come home, is to retain that. I feel so enriched by my climbing, and as I say, I've been doing it a long time, and I think it's sort of there permanently now. It's cemented in my character, and it allows me to keep a perspective. I always have the mountains, you know, you could say that.
You want to go back, don't you?
Yeah, so that doesn't. I would go back to Everest because it was such an astonishingly beautiful, powerful place. But it doesn't have to be Everest anywhere. You go to Tassie and go hiking. It's the same sort of thing. The high country, even here in Melbourne, you know the High Plains, Bogong. It's all the same sort of thing. The danger is a varying element, but it's all this stuff is the same sort of activity.
I guess it's the absence of our structures, the absence of the things that we coddle ourselves with.
Yeah, and I was thinking about how, you know, other ways that people get this same thing, and I was thinking about sailing, and I think I tried sailing for a while and it didn't work for me at all, and I think the difference was, for sailing you need a boat, and for climbing all you need is a boot. And this is another dimension of doing one of these big Himalayan mountains. You know, you start off in Melbourne, you carry maybe 60 kilos of gear over there, and you leave a bit in Kathmandu, and you leave a bit at base camp, and gradually you keep leaving a bit behind until when you're going for the summit, you have what you really need, which is about 10 kilos on your back. And that's what's beautiful about the mountains. It strips you down in so many ways, and that's one of them.
James, thank you.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Lost and Found, a Blueprint for Living production, this week on Everest. You heard James Strohfeldt, climber. Producers are Mira Adley-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla. Technical production by Matthew Crawford. I'm Jonathan Green.